Tamerlane would say no more. She returned to laying out the next day's lessons.
"We will continue tomorrow," she said, "teaching you to identify the sources of the various accents of spoken Galach." No one else, not even Teg or Patrine, would answer his questions about the punishments. Even the guards, when he saw them afterward, refused to speak of their ordeals. Some reacted curtly to his overtures, and none would play with him any more. There was no forgiveness among the punished. That much was clear. "Damn Shuangyu! Damn Shuangyu!" That was where his deep hatred of her began. All of the old witches shared in his hatred. Would the new young one be the same as the old ones? "Damn Shuangyu!" When he demanded of Shuangyu, "Why did you have to punish them?" Shuangyu took some time before answering. Then, "It is dangerous for you here on Gamu. There are people who wish you harm." Duncan did not ask why. This was another area where his questions were never answered. Not even Teg would answer, although Teg's very presence emphasized the fact of that danger. And Miles Teg was a mentat who must know many answers. Duncan often saw the old man's eyes glisten while his thoughts went far away. But there was no mentat response to such a question as, "Why are we here on Gamu? Who do you guard against? Who wants to harm me? Who are my parents?" Silence greeted such questions, or sometimes Teg would growl, "I cannot answer you." The library was useless. He had discovered this when he was only 8, and his chief instructor was a failed reverend mother named Lurinjiasa, not quite as ancient as Shuangyu, but well along in years. More than 100, anyway. At his demand, the library produced information about Gamu Gaiety Prime, about the Harkonnens and their fall, about various conflicts where Teg had commanded. None of those battles came through as very bloody. Several commentators referred to Teg's superb diplomacy. But one datum leading to another, Duncan learned about the time of the God Emperor and the taming of his people. This period commanded Duncan's attention for weeks. He found an old map in the records and projected it on the focus wall. The commentator's superimpositions told him that this very keep had been a fish speaker command center abandoned during the scattering. Fish speakers. Duncan wished then that he had lived during their time, serving as one of the rare male advisors in the female army that had worshipped the great God Emperor. Oh, to have lived on Rakis in those days! Teg was surprisingly forthcoming about the God Emperor, calling him always the Tyrant. A library lock was opened, and information about Rakis came pouring out for Duncan. "Will I ever see Rakis?" he asked Jasa. "You are being prepared to live there." The answer astonished him. Everything they taught him about that faraway planet came into new focus. "Why will I live there?" "I cannot answer that." With renewed interest, he returned to his studies of that mysterious planet and its miserable church of the Shai-Hulud, the divided god. Worms. The God Emperor had become those worms. The idea filled Duncan with awe. Perhaps here was something worthy of worship. The thought touched a chord in him. What had driven a man to accept that terrible metamorphosis? Duncan knew what his guards and the others in the keep thought about Rakis and the core of priesthood there. Sneering remarks and laughter told it all. Teg said, "We'll probably never know the whole truth of it, but I tell you, lad, that's no religion for a soldier." Shuangyu capped it. "You are to learn about the tyrant, but you are not to believe in his religion. That is beneath you, contemptible." In every spare study moment, Duncan pored over whatever the library produced for him. The Holy Book of the Divided God, the Guard Bible, the Orange Catholic Bible,
and even the Apocrypha. He learned about the long-defunct Bureau of the Faith and the pearl that is the Sun of Understanding. The very idea of the worms fascinated him, their size. A big one would stretch from one end of the keep to the other. Men had ridden the pre-tyrant worms, but the Rakian priesthood forbade this now. He found himself gripped by accounts from the archaeological team that had found the tyrant's primitive no-chamber on Rakis. Dar es Balat, the place was called. The reports by archaeologist Hadi Bonotto were marked suppressed by orders of the Rakian priesthood. The file number on the accounts from Bene Gesserit archives was a long one, and what Bonotto revealed was fascinating. A kernel of the God Emperor's awareness in each worm? He asked Jassa. So it said. And even if true, they are not conscious, not aware. The tyrant himself said he would enter an endless dream. Each study session occasioned a special lecture and Bene Gesserit explanations of religion, until finally he encountered those accounts called the Nine Daughters of Siona and the Thousand Sons of Idaho. Confronting Jassa, he demanded, "My name is Duncan Idaho, too. What does that mean?" Jassa always moved as though standing in the shadow of her failure, her long head bent forward and her watery eyes aimed at the ground. The confrontation occurred near evening in the long hall outside the practice floor. She paled at his question. When she did not answer, he demanded, "Am I descended from Duncan, Idaho?" "You must ask Shuang Yu." Jassa sounded as though the words pained her. It was a familiar response, and it angered him. She meant he would be told something to shut him up. Little information in the telling. Shuang Yu, however, was more open than expected. "You carry the authentic blood of Duncan, Idaho."
"Who are my parents?"
"They are long dead."
"How did they die?"
"I do not know. We received you as an orphan."
"Then why do people want to harm me?"
"They fear what you may do."
"What is it I may do?"
"Study your lessons. All will be made clear to you in time."
"Shut up and study." Another familiar answer. He obeyed because he had learned to recognize when the doors were closed on him. But now his questing intelligence met other accounts of the famine times and the scattering, the no chambers and no ships that could not be traced, not even by the most powerful prescient minds in their universe. Here he encountered the fact that descendants of Duncan, Idaho, and Siona, those ancients who had served the tyrant God Emperor, also were invisible to prophets and prescients. Not even a guild steersman deep in melange trance could detect such people. Siona, the accounts told him, was a true-bred Atreides, and Duncan, Idaho, was a Gola. Gola? He probed the library for elaborations on this peculiar word. Gola. The library produced for him no more than bare-boned accounts. Golas. Humans grown from a cadaver's cells in Tlilazu axolotl tanks.
Axolotl tanks?
A Tlilazu device for reproducing a living human being from the cells of a cadaver.
Describe a gola, he demanded.
Innocent flesh devoid of its original memories. See axolotl tanks. Duncan had learned to read the silences, the blank places in what the people of the keep revealed to him. Revelation swept over him. He knew. Only 10, and he knew. I am a gola. Late afternoon in the library, all of the esoteric machinery around him faded into a sensory background, and a 10-year-old sat silently before a scanner, hugging the knowledge to himself. I am a gola. He could not remember the axolotl tanks where his cells had grown into an infant. His first memories were of Jassa, picking him up from his cradle. The alert interest in those adult eyes that had so soon faded into wary lidding. It was as though the information so grudgingly supplied him by the keep's people and records had at last defined a central shape, himself. "Tell me about the Benate Lilacs," he demanded of the library. "They are a people self-divided into face dancers and masters. Face dancers are mules, sterile, and submissive to the masters." "Why did they do this to me?" The information machines of the library were suddenly alien and dangerous. He was afraid, not that his questions might meet more blank walls, but that he would receive answers. "Why am I so important to Shuang Yu and the others?" He felt that they had wronged him, even Miles Teg and Patrine. Was it right to take the cells of a human and produce a Gola? He asked the next question with great hesitation. "Can a Gola ever remember who he was?" "It can be done."
"How?"
"The psychological identity of Gola to original presets certain responses, which can be ignited by trauma."
No answer at all.
"But how?" Shuang Yu intruded at this point, arriving at the library unannounced. So something about his questions had been set to alert her.
"All will be made clear to you in time," she said.
She talked down to him. He sensed the injustice in it, the lack of truthfulness. Something within him said he carried more human wisdom in his unawakened self than the ones who presumed themselves so superior. His hatred of Shuang Yu reached a new intensity. She was the personification of all who tantalized him and frustrated his questions. Now, though, his imagination was on fire. He would recapture his original memories. He felt the truth of this. He would remember his parents, his family, his friends, his enemies. He demanded it of Shuang Yu. "Did you produce me because of my enemies?"
"You have already learned silence, child," she said. "Rely on that knowledge."
"Very well. That's how I will fight you, damn Shuang Yu. I will be silent, and I will learn. I won't show you how I really feel."
"You know," she said, "I think we're raising a stoic."
She patronized him. He would not be patronized. He would fight them all with silence and watchfulness. Duncan ran from the library and huddled in his room. In the following months, many things confirmed that he was a Gola. Even a child knew when things around him were extraordinary. He saw other children occasionally beyond the walls, walking along the perimeter road, laughing and calling. He found accounts of children in the library. Adults did not come to those children and engage them in rigorous training of the sort imposed on him. Other children did not have a reverend mother Shuang Yu to order every smallest aspect of their lives. His discovery precipitated another change in Duncan's life. Lauren Jassa was called away from him and did not return. "She was not supposed to let me know about Golas." The truth was somewhat more complex, as Shuang Yu explained to Lucilla on the observation parapet the day of Lucilla's arrival.
"We knew the inevitable moment would come. He would learn about Golas and ask the pointed questions."
It was high time a reverend mother took over his everyday education. Jassa may have been a mistake.
"Are you questioning my judgment?"
Shuang Yu snapped. "Is your judgment so perfect that it may never be questioned?" In Lucilla's soft contralto, the question had the impact of a slap. Shuang Yu remained silent for almost a minute. Presently she said,
"Jassa thought the Gola was an endearing child. She cried and said she would miss him."
"Wasn't she warned about that?"
"Jassa did not have our training."
So you replaced her with Tamerlane at that time?
I do not know Tamerlane, but I presume she is quite old.
Quite.
What was his reaction to the removal of Jassa?
He asked where she had gone. We did not answer.
How did Tamerlane fare?
On his third day with her, he told her very calmly, I hate you. Is that what I'm supposed to do?
So quickly.
Right now, he's watching you and thinking, I hate Shuangyu. Will I have to hate this new one? But he is also thinking that you are not like the other old witches. You're young. He will know that this must be important.
Humans live best when each has his place to stand, when each knows where he belongs in the scheme of things and what he may achieve. Destroy the place, and you destroy the person. Bene Gesserit Teaching. Miles Teg had not wanted the Gamu assignment. Weapons master to a Gola child? Even such a Gola child as this one, with all of the history woven around him. It was an unwanted intrusion into Teg's well-ordered retirement. But he had lived all of that life as a military mentat under the will of the Bene Gesserit, and could not compute an act of disobedience. Quis custodiet ipsos custodiet? Who shall guard the guardians? Who shall see that the guardians commit no offenses? This was a question that Teg had considered carefully on many occasions. It formed one of the basic tenets of his loyalty to the Bene Gesserit. Whatever else you might say about the sisterhood, they displayed an admirable constancy of purpose. Moral purpose, Teg labeled it. The Bene Gesserit moral purpose agreed completely with Teg's principles. That those principles were Bene Gesserit, conditioned in him, did not enter into the question. Rational thought, especially mentat rationality, could make no other judgment. Teg boiled it down to an essence. If only one person followed such guiding principles, this was a better universe. It was never a question of justice. Justice required resort to law, and that could be a fickle mistress, subject always to the whims and prejudices of those who administered the laws. No, it was a question of fairness, a concept that went much deeper. The people upon whom judgment was passed must feel the fairness of it. To Teg, statements such as, the letter of the law must be observed, were dangerous to his guiding principles. Being fair required agreement, predictable constancy, and above all else, loyalty upward and downward in the hierarchy. Leadership guided by such principles required no outside controls. You did your duty because it was right. And you did not obey because that was predictably correct. You did it because the rightness was a thing of this moment. Prediction and prescience had nothing whatsoever to do with it. Teg knew the Atreides' reputation for reliable prescience, but gnomic utterances had no place in his universe. You took the universe as you found it, and applied your principles where you could. Absolute commands in the hierarchy were always obeyed. Not that Terraza had made it a question of absolute command, but the implications were there. You are the perfect person for this task. He had lived a long life with many high points, and he was retired with honor. Teg knew he was old, slow, and with all the defects of age waiting just at the edges of his awareness. But the call to duty quickened him, even while he was forced to put down the wish to say no. The assignment had come from Terraza personally, the powerful senior of all, including the Missionaria Protectiva, singled him out. Not just a reverend mother, but the Reverend Mother Superior. Terraza came to his retirement sanctuary on Linnaeus. It honored him for her to do this, and he knew it. She appeared at his gate unannounced, accompanied only by two acolyte servers and a small guard force. some of whose faces he recognized. Teg had trained them himself. The time of her arrival was interesting. Morning, shortly after his breakfast. She knew the patterns of his life, and certainly knew that he was most alert at this hour. So she wanted him awake and at his fullest capabilities. Patrine, Teg's old batman, brought Terraza into the East Wing sitting room, a small and elegant setting with only solid furniture in it. Teg's dislike of chair dogs and other living furniture was well known. Patrine had a sour look on his face as he ushered the black-robed Mother Superior into the room. Teg recognized the look immediately. Patrine's long, pale face, with its many age wrinkles, might appear an unmoved mask to others. But Teg was alert to the deepened wrinkles beside the man's mouth, the set stare in the old eyes. So Terraza had said something on the way in here that had disturbed Patrine. Tall sliding doors of heavy plaz framed the room's eastward view, down a long sloping lawn to trees beside the river. Terraza paused just inside the room to admire the view. Without being told, Teg touched a button. Curtains slid across the view and glow globes came alight. Teg's action told Terraza he had computed a need for privacy. He emphasized this by ordering Patrine, "Please see that we are not disturbed." "The orders for the South Farm, sir," Patrine ventured. "Please see to that yourself. You and Fyrus know what I want." Patrine closed the door a little too sharply as he left. A tiny signal, but it spoke much to Teg. Terraza moved a pace into the room and examined it. "Lime green," she said. "One of my favorite colors. Your mother had a fine eye." Teg warmed to the remark. He had a deep affection for this building and this land. His family had been here only 3 generations, but their mark was on the place. His mother's touches had not really been changed in many rooms. "It's safe to love land and places," Teg said. "I particularly liked the burnt orange carpets in the hall and the stained glass fanlight over the entry door," Terraza said. "That fanlight is a real antique, I am sure." "You did not come here to talk about interior decoration," Teg said. Terraza chuckled. She had a high-pitched voice, which the sisterhood's training had taught her to use with devastating effectiveness. It was not a voice easy to ignore, even when she appeared most carefully casual, as she did now. Teg had seen her in Bene Gesserit Council. Her manner there was powerful and persuasive, every word an indicator of the incisive mind that guided her decisions. He could sense an important decision beneath her demeanor now. Teg indicated a green upholstered chair at his left. She glanced at it, swept her gaze once more around the room, and suppressed a smile. Not a chair dog in the house, she would wager. Teg was an antique, surrounding himself with antiques. She seated herself and smoothed her robe, while waiting for Teg to take a matching chair facing her. "I regret the need to ask that you come out of retirement, Bashar," she said. "Unfortunately, circumstances give me little choice." Teg rested his long arms casually on his chair's arms, a mentat in repose, waiting. His attitude said, "Fill my mind with data." Terraza was momentarily abashed. This was an imposition. Teg was still a regal figure, tall and with that large head topped by gray hair. He was, she knew, 4 SY short of 300. Granting that the standard year was some 20 hours less than the so-called primitive year, it was still an impressive age, with experiences in Bene Gesserit service that demanded that she respect him. Teg wore, she noted, a light gray uniform with no insignia, carefully tailored trousers and jacket, white shirt open at the throat to reveal a deeply wrinkled neck. There was a glint of gold at his waist, and she recognized the Bashar sunburst he had received at retirement. How like the utilitarian Teg!
he had made the gold bauble into a belt buckle. This reassured her. Teg would understand her problem.
"Could I have a drink of water?" Taraza asked. "It has been a long and tiresome journey. We came the last stage by one of our transports, which we should have replaced 500 years ago.
Teg lifted himself from the chair, went to a wall panel, and removed a chilled water bottle and glass from a cabinet behind the panel. He put these on a low table at Taraza's right hand.
"I have melange," he said.
"No, thank you, Miles. I've my own supply."
Teg resumed his seat, and she noted the signs of stiffness. He was still remarkably supple, however, considering his years. Taraza poured herself a half glass of water and drank it in one swallow. She replaced the glass on the side table with elaborate care. How to approach this? Teg's manner did not fool her. He did not want to leave retirement. Her analysts had warned her about that. Since retirement, he had taken more than a casual interest in farming. His extensive acreage here on Linnaeus was essentially a research garden. She lifted her gaze and studied him openly. Square shoulders accentuated Teg's narrow waist. He still kept himself active then. That long face with its sharp lines from the strong bones. Typically Atreides. Teg returned her gaze as he always did, demanding attention, but open to whatever the Mother Superior might say. His thin mouth was cocked into a slight smile, exposing bright and even teeth.
"He knows I'm uncomfortable," she thought. "Damn it. He's just as much a servant of the Sisterhood as I am."
Teg did not prompt her with questions. His manner remained impeccable, curiously withdrawn. She reminded herself that this was a common trait of Mentats, and nothing else should be read into it. Abruptly, Teg stood and strode to a sideboard at Taraza's left. He turned, folded his arms across his breast, and leaned there, looking down at her. Taraza was forced to swivel her chair to face him.
Damn him.
Teg was not going to make this any easier for her. All of the Reverend Mother examiners had remarked a difficulty in getting Teg to sit for conversation. He preferred to stand, his shoulders held with military stiffness, his gaze aimed downward. Few Reverend Mothers matched his height, more than 2 meters. This trait, the analysts agreed, was Teg's way, probably unconscious, of protesting the Sisterhood's authority over him. None of this, however, showed itself in his other behavior. Teg had always been the most reliable military commander the Sisterhood had ever employed. In a multi-society universe whose major binding forces interacted with complexity, despite the simplicity of labels, reliable military commanders were worth their weight in melange many times over. Religions and the common memory of imperial tyrannies always figured in the negotiations, but it was economic forces that eventually carried the day, and the military coin could be entered on anybody's adding machine. It was there in every negotiation, and would be for as long as necessity drove the trading system. The need for particular things, such as spice, or the techno-products of Ix. The need for specialists, such as Mentats or Sook doctors. And all of the other mundane needs for which there were markets. For labor forces, for builders, for designers, for planiformed life, for artists, for exotic pleasures. No legal system could bind such complexity into a whole, and this fact quite obviously brought up another necessity. The constant need for arbiters with clout. Reverend Mothers had naturally fallen into this role within the economic web, and Miles Teg knew this. He also knew that he was once more being brought out as a bargaining chip. Whether he enjoyed that role did not figure in the negotiations.
"It's not as though you had any family to hold you here," Taraza said.
Teg accepted this silently. Yes, his wife had been dead 38 years now. His children were all grown, and, with the exception of one daughter, gone from the nest. He had his many personal interests, but no family obligations. True.
Taraza reminded him then of his long and faithful service to the sisterhood, citing several memorable achievements. She knew the praise would have little effect on him, but it provided her with a needed opening for what must follow. "You have been apprised of your familial resemblance," she said. Tag inclined his head no more than a millimeter. "Your resemblance to the first Leto Atreides, grandfather of the tyrant, is truly remarkable," she said. Tag gave no sign that he heard or agreed. This was merely a datum, something already stored in his copious memory. He knew he bore Atreides' genes. He had seen the likeness of Leto the First at Chapter House. It had been oddly like looking into a mirror. "You're a bit taller," Taraza said. Tag continued to stare down at her. "Damn it all, Bashar," Taraza said. "Will you at least try to help me?" "Is that an order, Mother Superior?" "No, it's not an order." Tag smiled slowly. The fact that Taraza allowed herself such an explosion in front of him said many things. She would not do that with people she felt were untrustworthy. And she certainly would not permit herself such an emotional display with a person she considered merely an underling. Taraza sat back in her chair and grinned up at him. "All right," she said. "You've had your fun. Patrine said you would be most upset with me if I called you back to duty. I assure you that you are crucial to our plans."
"What plans, Mother Superior?"
"We are raising a Duncan, Idaho Gola on Gemu. He is almost 6 years old and ready for military education." Tag allowed his eyes to widen slightly. "It will be a taxing duty for you," Taraza said. "But I want you to take over his training and protection as soon as possible."
"My likeness to the Atreides Duke," Tag said. "You will use me to restore his original memories."
"In 8 or 10 years, yes."
"That long?" Tag shook his head.
"Why Gamu?" "His Prana Bindu inheritance has been altered by the Beni Tlelazu at our orders. His reflexes will match in speed those of anyone born in our times. Gamu, the original Duncan Idaho, was born and raised there. Because of the changes in his cellular inheritance, we must keep all else as close to the original conditions as possible."
"Why are you doing this?" It was a Mentat's data-conscious tone.
"A female child with the ability to control the worms had been discovered on Rakkis. We will have use for our Gola there."
"You will breed them?"
"I am not engaging you as a Mentat. It is your military abilities and your likeness to the original Leto that we need. You know how to restore his original memories when the time comes."
"So you're really bringing me back as a weapons master?"
"You think that's a come-down for the man who was supreme Bashar of all our forces?"
"Mother Superior, you command and I obey. But I will not accept this post without full command of all of Gamu's defenses."
"That already has been arranged, Miles. You always did know how my mind works. And I've always been confident of your loyalty."
Tag pushed himself away from the sideboard and stood a moment in thought. Then,
"Who will brief me?" "Belanda from Records, the same as before. She will provide you with a cipher to secure the exchange of messages between us."
"I will give you a list of people," Tag said.
"Old comrades, and the children of some of them. I will want all of them waiting on Gamu when I arrive."
"You don't think any of them will refuse?"
His look said, "Don't be silly."
Taraza chuckled, and she thought, "There's a thing we learned well from the original Atreides, how to produce people who command the utmost devotion and loyalty."
"Patrine will handle the recruiting," Tag said. "He won't accept rank, I know, but he's to get the full pay and courtesies of a colonel aide."
"You will, of course, be restored to the rank of Supreme Bashar," she said.
We will...
No, you have Burzmali. We will not weaken him by bringing back his old commander over him. She studied him a moment, then... We have not yet commissioned Burzmali as... I am well aware of that. My old comrades keep me fully informed of sisterhood politics. But you and I, Mother Superior, know it's only a matter of time. Burzmali is the best. She could only accept this. It was more than a military mentat's assessment. It was Teg's assessment. Another thought struck her. Then you already knew about our dispute in council, she accused. And you let me... Mother Superior... If I thought you would produce another monster on Rakkis, I would have said so. You trust my decisions, I trust yours. Damn you, Miles, we've been apart too long. Terraza stood. I feel calmer just knowing you'll be back in harness. Harness, he said. Yes. Reinstate me as a Bashar on special assignment. That way, when word gets back to Burzmali... There'll be no silly questions. Terraza produced a sheaf of Redulian papers from beneath her robe and passed them to Teg. I've already signed these. Fill in your own reinstatement. The other authorizations are all there, transport vouchers and so on. I give you these orders personally. You are to obey me. You are my Bashar. Do you understand? Wasn't I always? He asked. It's more important than ever now. Keep that Golba safe and train him well. He's your responsibility. And I will back you in that against anyone. I hear Shuang Yu commands on Gemu. Against anyone, Miles. Don't trust Shuang Yu.
I see.
Will you lunch with us? My daughter has...
Forgive me, Miles, but I must get back soonest.
I will send Balanda at once. Teg saw her to the door, exchanged a few pleasantries with his old students in her party, and watched as they left. They had an armored ground car waiting in the drive, one of the new models that they obviously had brought with them. Sight of it gave Teg an uneasy feeling. Urgency. Terraza had come in person, the Mother Superior herself on a messenger's errand. Knowing what that would reveal to him. Knowing so intimately how the sisterhood performed, he saw the revelation in what had just happened. The dispute in the Bene Gesserit Council went far deeper than his informants had suggested. You are my Bashar. Teg glanced through the sheaf of authorizations and vouchers Terraza had left with him, already carrying her seal and signature. The trust this implied added to the other things he sensed and increased his disquiet. Don't trust Shuang Yu. He slipped the papers into his pocket and went in search of Patrine. Patrine would have to be briefed and mollified. They would have to discuss whom to call in for this assignment. He began to list some of the names in his mind. Dangerous duty ahead. It called for only the best people. Damn. Everything on the estate here would have to be passed over to Phyrus and Demela. So many details. He felt his pulse quicken as he strode through the house. Passing a house guard, one of his old soldiers, Teg paused. Martin, cancel all of my appointments for today. Find my daughter and tell her to meet me in my study. Word spread through the house and from there across the estate. Servants and family, knowing that the Reverend Mother Superior had just conversed privately with him, automatically set up a protective screen to keep idle distractions away from Teg. His eldest daughter, Demela, cut him short when he tried to list details necessary to carry on his experimental farm projects. Father, I am not an infant. They were in the small greenhouse attached to his study. Remains of Teg's lunch sat on the corner of a potting bench. Patrine's notebook was propped against the wall behind the luncheon tray. Teg looked sharply at his daughter. Demela favored him in appearance, but not in height. Too angular to be a beauty, but she had made a good marriage.
They had three fine children, Demela and Phyrus.
Where is Phyrus? Teg asked.
He's out seeing to the replanting of the South Farm.
Oh, yes, Patrine mentioned that.
Teg smiled. It had always pleased him that Demela had refused the sisterhood's bid, preferring to marry Phyrus, a native of Linnaeus, and remain in her father's entourage.
All I know is that they're calling you back to duty, Demela said.
Is it a dangerous assignment?
You know you sound exactly like your mother, Teg said.
So it is dangerous.
Damn them. Haven't you done enough for them?
Apparently not. She turned away from him as Patrine entered the far end of the greenhouse. He heard her speak to Patrine as they passed.
The older he gets, the more he gets like a reverend mother himself.
What else could she expect, Teg wondered. The son of a reverend mother? Fathered by a minor functionary of the Combine Honnet Oberadvancer Mercantiles, he had matured in a household that moved to the sisterhood's beat. It had been apparent to him at an early age that his father's allegiance to Chome's interplanetary trading network vanished when his mother objected. This house had been his mother's house until her death less than a year after his father died. The imprint of her choices lay all around him. Patrine stopped in front of him.
I came back for my notebook. Have you added any names?
A few. You'd better get right on it.
Yes, sir.
Patrine did a smart about face and strode back the way he had come, slapping the notebook against his leg.
He feels it too, Teg thought.
Once more, Teg glanced around him. This house was still his mother's place. After all the years he had lived here, raised a family here, still her place. Oh, he had built this greenhouse, but the study there had been her private room. Janet Roxborough, of the Linnaeus Roxboroughs. The furnishings, the decor, still her place. Terraza had seen that. He and his wife had changed some of the surface objects, but the core remained Janet Roxborough's. No question about the fish speaker blood in that lineage. What a prize she had been for the sisterhood. That she had wed Loshi Teg and lived out her life here, that was the oddity. An undigestible fact, until you knew how the sisterhood's breeding designs worked over the generations. They've done it again, Teg thought. They've had me waiting in the wings all these years, just for this moment. Has not religion claimed a patent on creation for all of these millennia? The Tlilazu question from Moadib speaks. The air of Tlilax was crystalline, gripped by a stillness that was part the morning chill and part a sense of fearful crouching, as though life waited out there in the city of Bandalong. Life anticipating and ravenous, which would not stir until it received his personal signal. The Mahai, Tylwith Waff, master of the masters, enjoyed this hour more than any other of the day. The city was his now as he looked out through his open window. Bandalong would come alive only at his command. This was what he told himself. The fear that he could sense out there was his hold on any reality that might arise from that incubating reservoir of life. The Tlilazu civilization that had originated here and then spread its powers afar. They had waited millennia for this time, his people. Waf savored the moment now, all through the bad times of the prophet Leto II, not God Emperor, but God's messenger. All through the famines and the scattering, through every painful defeat at the hands of lesser creatures, through all of those agonies the Tlilazu had built their patient forces for this moment. We have come to our moment, O Prophet. The city that lay beneath his high window he saw as a symbol, one strong mark on the page of Tlilazu design.
Other Tlilazu planets, other great cities, interlinked, interdependent, and with central allegiance to his god and his city, awaited the signal that all of them knew must come soon. The twinned forces of Face Dancers and Mershik had compressed their powers in preparation for the cosmic leap. The millennia of waiting were about to end. Waff thought of it as the long beginning. Yes, he nodded to himself as he looked at the crouching city. From its inception, from that infinitesimal kernel of an idea, many Tlilax leaders had understood the perils of a plan so extended, so protracted, so convoluted and subtle. They had known they must surmount near disaster time and again, accept galling losses, submissions, and humiliations. All of this and much more had gone into the construction of a particular Bene Tlilax image. By those millennia of pretense, they had created a myth. The vile, detestable, dirty Tlilazu, the stupid Tlilazu, the predictable Tlilazu, the impetuous Tlilazu. Even the prophet's minions had fallen prey to this myth. A captive fish speaker had stood in this very room and shouted at a Tlilazu master, "Long pretense creates a reality. You are truly vile." So they had killed her, and the prophet did nothing. How little all of those alien worlds and peoples understood Tlilazu restraint. Impetuosity? Let them reconsider after the Bene Tlilax demonstrated how many millennia they were capable of waiting for their ascendancy.
Spannungsbogen.
Waff rolled the ancient word on his tongue. The span of the bow. How far back you draw the bow before releasing your arrow. This arrow would strike deep. The Mashik have waited longer than any other, Waff whispered. He dared to utter the word to himself here in his tower fastness. Mashik. The rooftops below him glittered as the sun lifted. He could hear the stirrings of the city's life. The sweet bitterness of Tlilazu's smells drifted on the air coming in his window. Waff inhaled deeply and closed his window. He felt renewed by his moment of solitary observation. Turning away from the window, he donned the white Kylot robe of honor to which all Jomel were conditioned to bow. The robe completely covered his short body, giving him the distinct feeling that it actually was armor. The armor of God. "We are the people of the Yagist," he had reminded his counselors only last night. "All else is frontier. We have fostered the myth of our weakness and evil practices for these millennia with only one purpose. Even the Bene Gesserit believe." Seated in the deep, windowless Sagra with its no-chamber shield, his nine counselors had smiled in silent appreciation of his words. In the judgment of the Gufran, they knew. The stage upon which the Tlilaxu determined their own destiny had always been the Kel with its rite of Gufran. It was proper that even Waff, the most powerful of all Tlilaxu, could not leave his world and be readmitted without abasing himself in the Gufran, begging pardon for contact with the unimaginable sins of aliens. To go out among the Powinda could soil even the mightiest. The Kasadars, who policed all Tlilaxu frontiers and guarded the Salamliks of the women, were right to suspect even Waff. He was of the people and the Kel, yes, but he must prove it each time he left the Heartland and returned, and certainly every time he entered the Salamlik for the distribution of his sperm. Waff crossed to his long mirror and inspected himself and his robe. To the Powindas he knew, he appeared an elfin figure barely a meter and a half tall. Eyes, hair, and skin were shades of gray. All the stage were the oval face with its tiny mouth and line of sharp teeth. A face dancer might mimic his features and pose, might dissemble at a Mashik's command,
but no Mashik or Kasadar would be fooled. Only the Pawindas would be gulled, except for the Bene Gesserit. This thought brought a scowl to his face. Well, the witches had yet to encounter one of the new face dancers.
No other people have mastered the genetic language as well as have the Bene Tlilax, he assured himself. We are right to call it the language of God, for God himself has given us this great power.
Waf strode to his door and waited for the morning bell. There was no way, he thought, to describe the richness of emotion he felt now. Time unfolded for him. He did not ask why the prophet's true message had been heard only by the Bene Tlilax. It had been God's doing, and in that the prophet had been the arm of God, worthy of respect as God's messenger. You prepared them for us, O prophet. And the Golan Gamu, this Gola at this time was worth all of the waiting. The morning bell sounded, and Waf strode out into the hall, turned with other emerging white-robed figures, and went on to the eastern balcony to greet the sun. As the Mahai and Abdul of his people, he could now identify himself with all Tlilaxu. We are the legalists of the Shariat, the last of our kind in the universe. Nowhere outside the sealed chambers of his Malik brothers could he reveal such a secret thought, but he knew it was a thought shared in every mind around him now. And the workings of that thought were visible in Mashik, Domel, and Face Dancer alike. The paradox of kinship ties and a sense of social identity that permeated the Kel from Mashik down to the lowliest Domel was not a paradox to Waf. We work for the same God. A Face Dancer in the guise of Domel had bowed and opened the balcony doors. Waf, emerging into sunlight with his many companions close around, smiled at recognition of the face dancer. A Domel yet. It was a kin joke, but face dancers were not kin. They were constructs, tools, just as the Golan Gamu was a tool, all designed with the language of God spoken only by Mashiks. With the others who pressed close around him, Waf made obeisance to the sun. He uttered the cry of the Abdul, and heard it echoed by countless voices from the farthest reaches of the city.
The sun is not God, he shouted.
No, the sun was only a symbol of God's infinite powers and mercy, another construct, another tool. Feeling cleansed by his passage through the Gufran the previous night, renewed by the morning ritual, Waf could think now about the trip outward to Pawinda places, and the return just completed, which had made Gufran necessary. Other worshippers made way for him as he went back to the inner corridors and entered the slide passage that dropped him to the central garden, where he had asked his counselors to meet him. It was a successful foray among the Pawinda, he thought. Every time he left the inner worlds of the Bene Tlilax, Waf felt himself to be on a Lashkar, a war party seeking that ultimate revenge which his people named secretly as Bodal, always capitalized and always the first thing reaffirmed in Gufran or Kel. This most recent Lashkar had been exquisitely successful. Waf emerged from the slide into a central garden filled with sunlight by prismatic reflectors on the surrounding rooftops. A small fountain played its visual fugue at the heart of a graveled circle. A low fence of white palings at one side enclosed a closely cropped lawn, a space near enough to the fountain that the air would be moist, but not so close that the splashing water would intrude on low-voiced conversation. Around the grassy enclosure, 10 narrow benches of an ancient plastic were arranged, 9 of them in a semicircle facing a 10th bench set slightly apart. Pausing at the edge of the grassy enclosure, Waf glanced around him, wondering why he had never before felt quite this intense pleasure at sight of the place. The dark blue of the benches was intrinsic to the material. Centuries of use had worn the benches into soft curves along the armrests, and where countless bottoms had planted themselves,
but the color was just as strong in the worn places as it was elsewhere. Waff sat down facing his nine counselors, marshaling the words he knew he must use. The document he had brought back from his latest Lashkar, indeed the very reason for that excursion, could not have been more exquisitely timed. The label on it and the words carried a mighty message for the Tlilazu. From an inner pocket, Waff removed the thin sheaf of Redulian crystal. He noted the quickened interest of his counselors. Nine faces similar to his own. Mashiks of the innermost Kel. All reflected expectancy. They had read this document in Kel. The Atreides Manifesto. They had spent a night of reflection on the manifesto's message. Now the words must be confronted. Waff placed the document on his lap.
"I propose to spread these words far and wide," Waff said.
"Without change?" That was Murlat, the counselor closest to Gola transformation among all of them. Murlat no doubt aspired to Abdul and Mahai. Waff focused on the counselor's wide jaws, where the cartilage had grown over the centuries as a visible mark of his current body's great age.
"Exactly as it has come into our hands," Waff said.
"Dangerous," Murlat said. Waff turned his head to the right, his childlike profile outlined against the fountain for his counselors to observe. "God's hand is on my right." The sky above him was polished carnelian, as though Bandalong, the most ancient city of the Tlilazu, had been built under one of those gigantic artificial covers erected to protect pioneers on the harsher planets. When he returned his attention to his counselors, Waff's features remained bland.
"Not dangerous to us," he said.
"A matter of opinion," Murlat said.
"Then let us consider opinions," Waff said. "Have we a need to fear Ix or the fish speakers?" "Indeed not. They are ours, although they do not know it."
Waff let this sink in. All of them knew that new face dancers sat in the highest councils of Ix and fish speakers, the exchange undetected.
"The guild will not move against us or oppose us, because we are their only secure source of melange," Waff said.
"Then what of these honored maters return from the scattering?" Murlat demanded.
"We will deal with them when it is required of us," Waff said. "And we will be helped by the descendants of our own people, who voluntarily went out into the scattering."
"The time does appear opportune," one of the other counselors murmured. It was Torg the Younger who had spoken, Waff observed. Good. There was a vote secured.
"The Bene Gesserit," Murlat snapped. "I think the honored maters will remove the witches from our path," Waff said. "Already they growl against each other like animals in the fighting pit."
"What if the author of that manifesto is identified?" Murlat demanded. "What then?" Several heads nodded among the counselors. Waff marked them. People to be won over.
"It is dangerous to be called Atreides in this age," he said.
"Except perhaps on Gemu," Murlat said. "And the name Atreides has been signed to that document."
How odd, Waff thought. The Chome representative at the Powinda conference that had taken Waff away from the inner planets of Tlilax had emphasized that very point. But most of Chome's people were secret atheists who looked on all religion as suspect, and certainly the Atreides had been a potent religious force. Chome worries had been almost palpable. Waff recounted this Chome reaction now.
"This Chome hireling, damn his godless soul, is right," Murlat insisted. "The document's insidious."
"Murlat will have to be dealt with," Waff thought.
He lifted the manifesto from his lap and read the first line aloud.
"In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God."
"Directly from the Orange Catholic Bible," Murlat said.
Once more, heads nodded in worried agreement. Wap showed the points of his canines in a brief smile.
"Do you suggest that there are those among the Powinda who suspect the existence of the Shariat and the Mashiks?"
It felt good to speak these words openly, reminding his listeners that only here among the innermost Lilaxu were the old words and the old language preserved without change. Did Merlot or any of the others fear that Atreides' words could subvert the Shariat? Waf posed this question too and saw the worried frowns.
"Is there one among you," Waf asked, "who believes that a single Powinda knows how we use the language of God? There, let them think on that. Every one of them here have been wakened time after time in Gola flesh. There was a fleshly continuity in this council that no other people had ever achieved. Merlot himself had seen the prophet with his own eyes. Saitali had spoken to Muad'Dib. Learning how the flesh could be renewed and the memories restored, they had condensed this power into a single government whose potency was confined, lest it be demanded everywhere. Only the witches had a similar storehouse of experience upon which to draw, and they moved with fearful caution, terrified that they might produce another Kwisatz Haderach." Wav said these things to his counselors, adding, "The time for action has come." When no one spoke disagreement, Waf said, "This manifesto has a single author. Every analysis agrees. Merlot?"
"Written by one person, and that person a true Atreides, no doubt of it," Merlot agreed.
"All at the Powinda Conference affirmed this," Waf said. "Even a third stage guild steersman agrees.
But that one person has produced a thing that excites violent reactions among diverse peoples," Merlot argued.
"Have we ever questioned the Atreides' talent for disruption?" Wath asked. "When the Powinda showed me this document, I knew God had sent us a signal."
"Do the witches still deny authorship?" Torg the Younger asked.
How alertly apt he is, Wath thought.
"Every Powinda religion is called into question by this manifesto," Waf said. "Every faith except ours is left hanging in limbo."
"Exactly the problem," Merlot pounced.
"But only we know this," Waf said. "Who else even suspects the existence of the Shariat?"
"The Guild," Merlot said.
"They have never spoken of it, and they never will. They know what our response would be."
Waf lifted the sheaf of papers from his lap and again read aloud.
"Forces that we cannot understand permeate our universe. We see the shadows of those forces when they are projected upon a screen available to our senses. But understand them we do not."
"The Atreides who wrote that knows of the Shariat," Merlot muttered.
Waf continued reading as though there had been no interruption.
"Understanding requires words. Some things cannot be reduced to words. There are things that can only be experienced wordlessly."
As though he handled a holy relic, Waf returned the document to his lap, softly, so that his listeners were required to bend toward him, and some cupped a hand behind an ear. Waf said,
"This says our universe is magical. It says all arbitrary forms are transient and subject to magical changes. Science has led us to this interpretation, as though it placed us on a track from which we cannot deviate."
He allowed these words to fester for a moment, then,
"No Rakian priest of the divided god, nor any other Powinda charlatan can accept that. Only we know it because our god is a magical god whose language we speak."
"We will be accused of the authorship," Merlot said.
The moment he had spoken, Merlot shook his head sharply from side to side.
"No, I see it. I see what you mean."
Waf held his silence. He could see that all of them were reflecting on their Sufi origins, recalling the great belief in the Zen-Sunni ecumenism that had spawned the Beni Tlilaks. The people of this Kel knew the God-given facts of their origins, but generations of secrecy assured that no Pawinda shared their knowledge. Words flowed silently through Waf's mind. Assumptions based on understanding contain belief in absolute ground, out of which all things spring like plants growing from seeds. Knowing that his counselors also recalled this catechism of the great belief, Waf reminded them of the Zen Sunni admonition. Behind such assumptions lies a faith in words that the Pawinda do not question. Only the Shariat question, and we do so silently.
His counselors nodded in unison. Waf inclined his head slightly and continued.
The act of saying that things exist that cannot be described in words shakes a universe where words are the supreme belief.
Pawinda poison! His counselors shouted.
He had them all now, and Waf hammered home his victory by demanding, What is the Sufi Zen Sunni credo? They could not speak it, but all reflected on it. To achieve Satori, no understanding is needed. Satori exists without words, without even a name. In a moment, all of them looked up and exchanged knowing glances. Murlot took it upon himself to recite the Tlilazu pledge.
I can say God, but that is not my God. That is only a noise, and no more potent than any other noise.
I now see, Waf said, that you all sense the power that has fallen into our hands through this document. Millions upon millions of copies already are being circulated among the Pawinda.
Who does this? Murlot asked.
Who cares? Waf countered. Let the Pawinda chase after them, seeking their origin, trying to suppress them, preaching against them. With each such action, the Pawinda inject more power into these words.
Should we not preach against these words, too? Murlot asked.
Only if the occasion demands it, Waf said.
See you?
He slapped the papers against his knees. The Pawinda have constricted their awareness to its tightest purpose, and that is their weakness. We must ensure that this manifesto gains as wide a circulation as possible.
The magic of our God is only our bridge, the counselors intoned.
All of them, Waf observed, had been restored to the central security of their faith. It had been easily managed.
No Marshik shared the Pawinda stupidity that whined, In thy infinite grace, God, why me? In one sentence, the Pawinda invoked infinity and denied it, never once observing their own foolishness.
Saitale, Waf said.
The youngest and most baby-faced of the counselors, seated at the far left as was fitting, leaned forward eagerly.
Arm the faithful, Waf said.
I marvel that an Atreides has given us this weapon, Murlot said. How can it be that the Atreides always fasten upon an ideal that enlists the billions who must follow?
It is not the Atreides, it is God, Waf said.
He lifted his arms then and spoke the closing ritual.
The Mashik have met in Kel and felt the presence of their God.
Waf closed his eyes and waited for the others to leave.
Mashik.
How good it was to name themselves in Kel, speaking the language of Islamiyat, which no Tlilazu spoke outside his own secret councils. Not even to face dancers did they speak it.
Nowhere in the Wekht of Yandola, not to the farthest reaches of the Tlilazu Yagist, was there a living Pawinda who knew this secret.
Yagist, Waf thought, rising from his bench. Yagist, the land of the unruled. He thought he could feel the document vibrating in his hand. This Atreides manifesto was the very kind of thing the masses of Pawinda would follow to their doom. Some days it's melange. Some days it's bitter dirt.
Rockian aphorism.
In her third year with the priests of Rakis, the girl Shiana lay full length atop a high curving dune.
She peered into the morning distance where a great rumbling friction could be heard. The light was a ghostly silver that frosted the horizon with filmy haze. The night's chill still lay on the sand. She knew the priests were watching her from the safety of their water-girded tower some 2 kilometers behind her. But this gave her little concern. The trembling of the sand beneath her body demanded full attention. "It's a big one," she thought. 70 meters at least. A beautiful big one." The gray stillsuit felt slick and smooth against her skin. It had none of the abrasive patches of the old hand-me-down she had worn before the priests took her into their care. She felt thankful for the fine stillsuit and the thick robe of white and purple that covered it. But most of all, she felt the excitement of being here. Something rich and dangerous filled her at moments such as this. The priests did not understand what happened here. She knew this. They were cowards. She glanced over her shoulder at the distant tower and saw sun glint on lenses. A precocious child of 11 standard years, slender and dark-skinned with sun-streaked brown hair, she could visualize clearly what the priests saw through their spying lenses. "They see me doing what they do not dare. They see me in the path of Shaitan. I look very small on the sand, and Shaitan looks very big. They can see him already."